morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for making us so welcome. It's great to see old Sangha friends and make some new Sangha friends. And I don't know how we got so lucky with the weather, but it's just glorious out there. The air is so bracing, fresh. I don't think there's anybody here who wasn't here either Friday evening or Saturday. Yeah, so I think everybody knows that we're kind of bringing our mountain rain practice period theme of suffering and resilience into our talks about Sangha practice. Because, of course, there's suffering and Sangha practice. We bring our karmic lives along with us. And our very practice, everything about our practice, supports the capacities of resilience that we so need in this world today. So I think it's kind of reassuring that even the Buddha had difficulty with Sangha relationships. His own cousin, Devadatta, tried to stir up dissension in the Sangha and take over leadership. It sounds like Devadatta was kind of an intolerant fundamentalist who thought that the Buddha was too lenient. You know, so he wanted to just make everything really, really, really strict and really ascetic and. He had a very harsh personality, and he even tried to murder the Buddha. I mean, what kind of karma is that? To try and murder the Buddha. He failed. Fortunately for all of us, he failed. And then there was a dispute. The first big dispute in the Sangha was between two senior Sangha leaders. One who taught the monastic precepts, and one who taught the sutras. So you can picture two different kind of personality types. Here's what happened. Here is the account of the petty circumstance that led to the first great quarrel, which threatened to produce a schism in the Sangha. It seems there were two bhikkhus, bhikkhus are monks, in one monastery, one an expert in the discipline and the other a teacher of discourses. The latter went to the latrine one day and left a vessel there with some unused washing water in it. The other went in later and found it there. He asked the teacher of the discourses, "Did you leave that vessel of water in there?" "Yes." "You did not know it was an offense?" "No, I did not." "It constitutes an offense." "Then I will acknowledge it. But if you did it unintentionally and out of forgetfulness, there was no offense." The teacher of discourses went away under the impression that he had done no wrong. However, the expert in discipline told his pupils, "This teacher of discourses does not know when he has committed an offense." They told the other's pupils, "Your preceptor has committed an offense, though he is under the impression that he does not." When they told their preceptor of this, he said, "This discipline expert said first that there was no offense, and now he says there was one. He is a liar." They told the pupils of the expert in discipline, "Your preceptor says he is a liar." So, you know, has anything changed in 2,500 years? Doesn't this sound kind of like any number of possible spheres in our society? And spiritual practice not being exempt. Not being exempt. So here's what the Buddha said in response to this petty quarrel. "When many voices shout at once, there is none thinks himself a fool. The order being split, none thinks, I took part, I helped in this. They have forgotten wise speech. They talk with minds obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed their mouths, they bawl at will. None knows what leads him to do so. And then he quotes the famous, the Buddha quoting his own teachings, the famous words from the Dhammapada, one of the earliest records of the Buddha's teachings. He abused me, he beat me, he worsted me, he robbed me. Hate is never appeased in those who cherish such enmity. He abused me, he beat me, he worsted me, he robbed me. Hate is surely appeased in those who cherish no such enmity. It is never in this world appeased. It is appeased by amity. This is the ancient principle. Sometimes the wording is hatred never ceases through hatred. Hatred only ceases through love. That's how that's often been translated, those lines from the Dhammapada. So, you know, over the centuries, over the millennia, human greed, hatred, and ignorance arise endlessly. And our bodhisattva vow is to see them clearly, to see their deep, deep roots, and to nourish the seeds of wisdom and kindness in our everyday lives. Michael mentioned yesterday that it seems like often people come to a Zen center because they want to learn how to meditate, right? Because they want relief from their stressed out lives, from anxiety, depression, self-esteem issues. The world's a stressful place. These are not unworthy motivations. They're natural. It's natural for us to want more ease in our lives. So that's where we start. That's the Dharma gate, with an awareness that we are suffering. A smaller number, and this is based kind of on my observations of who shows up at the Mountain Rain Zendo and what they say, a smaller proportion come because they want to learn about the Dharma. They've heard about Buddhist teachings and practices. They've tried meditating on their own sometimes, or maybe they've been to one kind of retreat, and they just want to learn more. They want to go deeper. Others, on the other hand, have read shelves and shelves of books, but they've never sat down and practiced zazen. And they realize, oh, there's a kind of a discrepancy here. Sometimes they can talk the talk pretty convincingly, but in their actual practice, in their way of manifesting their lives, is very dysregulated. Is very they can't even sit for 10 minutes. People have come to the Zendo, and that's really kind of painful, because their ideas are so strong, but their embodied practice is very challenging sometimes. So there's different gates for different people, right? An even smaller minority show up saying, I realize I need to practice with other people. I need community. I want to meet others who share my practice and my concerns. This is my completely unscientific speculation, but I suspect that those folks who recognize that they need and want other people to practice with are better equipped to come into Sangha practice and engage with it with a more realistic view toward to, to other people in their frailties and humanity, that perhaps they will have less, you know, there's a tendency to come into practice with the idea that, oh, well, these are all Buddhists, right? So that they should be kind and not be neurotic and and not be mean to me. And and the Andes even further up, if the person has a raksu or a robe on, they should be really, really upright and perfect and attentive and know and see me. And so it's really hard when that person is inattentive or self-absorbed in some way or opinionated. So it's hard to encounter human beings in a sangha and to really realize that we come with all our karmic lives into community together. And that's the grist for our mill of practice. Yeah, so Michael mentioned, you know, a lot, probably the majority of people who come to practice are really interested in, you know, Buddha, Dharma, but the Sangha is, oh, I'm not so sure. Do I really have to deal with people? You know, I do that all the time in my regular, you know, everyday life. But if we were free, I think Michael said this too, if we were free of our karmic lives, we'd probably be out in the world living as bodhisattvas and not necessarily be drawn. I mean, there are people out there who aren't Buddhists, who are living bodhisattva lives in the world of kindness and wisdom and service. They're all over. But I think that somewhere in all of us is a kind of latent realization that our freedom from suffering, our freedom from obstruction, the obstructions that cloud our minds, our cloud our clear seeing, that contaminate our speech and actions, our freedom from that will benefit not just us, but everyone and everything around us. And that awareness comes from being latent into a more conscious intention as we practice, and that conscious intention and aspiration to be free for the benefit of ourselves and all beings. It's called bodhicitta, the mind of awakening. So I think maybe we all have a kind of embryonic bodhicitta that over time, yeah, strengthens. And we come to realize this, I think, through Sangha practice. Through Sangha practice. Kind of seeing ourselves and others become lighter and more flexible, more open. When we make our bodhisattva vows to awaken for and with all beings, we vow to live here in samsara, in the world of suffering, and to meet beings, to meet ourselves and other beings as we are in each moment, knowing that that is ever-changing. The Vimalakirti Sutra, you may have heard that name, depicts the great legendary enlightened layman Vimalakirti, who is said to have lived at the time of the Buddha as an enlightened householder. He had a family. He was some kind of merchant, but lived very, very simply. And the sutra is his encounter with a company of Buddha's disciples and bodhisattvas who gathered in his little room when he was ill. And he gave all these teachings. It's a wonderful sutra. It's really fun because it's actually humorous. It's one of the few sutras that's actually humorous. But I'm going to just condense a little bit out of it. And what he says at one point is that the bodhisattva is able to frequent the busy crossroads in order to bring benefit to others, enter the government offices and courts of law so as to aid and rescue all those she can. She would visit the places of debate, the schools and study halls, and enter houses of ill fame and wine shops. He could do this without being ensnared by the many addictions and distractions, conflicts and competitions that are all with us today, too. The bodhisattva also makes no distinction between rich and poor, and in those days, the castes of Indian society. So we have to, on our path, be able to meet beings wherever they are, and we need to be able to go there and meet them. And some of us do that in our daily life, in our work. So to follow Vimalakirti's example, we have to be able to face human fallibility, human weakness in ourselves and others, with wisdom and kindness and patience. And we must maintain our practice our whole lives, never resting on our laurels, never thinking, oh, I had that big Satori experience. I know what no self is. Now I'm home free. As soon as we do that, we're likely to trip up. And we live in a web of human karmic life. And so we need to see clearly, as we chant all my ancient twisted karma, see into the deep, deep roots of suffering and fully avow it. Most sanghas in the West are lay sanghas, right? Just like us, having, you know, setting up zendos in improbable locations. And we're people who have family and work responsibilities, who also want to make a commitment to practice, to walking the bodhisattva path. And in our particular Zen tradition, even priest ordination does not require lifelong celibate monastic life. Many priests live in the world, have jobs, and also their sangha commitments, and families. Some have families too. We're not practicing in a cloistered monastery. Not that practicing in a cloistered monastery is proof against human weakness, greed, aversion, and delusion. We've all heard and seen about stories about the harm done in monastic environments where character development, ethical behavior is not fully developed in that monastic environment. Or, you know, when teachers who have been reared in the monastic environment of the East have come to the West in Western society and lay practice, it can be very disorienting and confusing, and they can become unmoored and do harm. We've all heard those stories. In our contemporary sanghas, both the monasteries and lay practice are permeable. There's a movement back and forth, right? Lay people coming into monastic practice, people who've done years of monastic practice going out and joining lay communities. And so we've had to develop means of decision-making and communicating that serve us well and make for safe and respectful practice environments for a more diverse array of participants in terms of gender, race, class, age, than a traditional monastic center, which is, you know, would be for the most part, all male. You know, you go to a training monastery in Japan, and it's all, you know, young men in their 20s. And that's not what our practice centers are like. So today I want to look at a little bit what our Buddha ancestors have to offer in the way of advice, and then some contemporary contributions to the discussion. So I want to start with the Buddha himself. Already mentioned a little bit, but in the year before the Buddha died, he was very, very careful to spend time with his Sangha and prepare them to go on without him and to take responsibility. He was ill, he was in his 80s, but he was very conscientious about this. And there's a long passage in the Parinirvana Sutra. The Parinirvana Sutra is about his death, where he gives long lists. He gives five lists of seven things that will prevent the decline of the Sangha, plus one list of six. I'm not going to read you all those lists, but just this is just the first one. And it goes like this. As long as the practitioners hold regular and frequent assemblies, as long as they meet in harmony, depart in harmony, and carry on their affairs in harmony, as long as they honor and respect the elders within the Sangha, as long as they do not fall under the influence of craving, as long as they preserve their personal mindfulness, so that in the future the good among their companions will come to them, and those who have already come will feel at ease with them. And as long as the practitioners hold to these things and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So that's just the first paragraph. And then it goes on and on and on, where he's really reminding them of the paramitas and the precepts and all the kind of practices that support a healthy community. He really covers the ground. So then jumping all the way from the time of the Buddha to 600 years ago, to Dogen Zenji, who founded our particular school of Buddhism in Japan, brought the practice from China to Japan, he composed, once he founded the main monastery that still exists today, Eheji, he composed the Eihei Shingi, which is translated as the Pure Standards for the Zen Community. And it goes exhaustively into every detail of how monastic life should be conducted. Every time we enter the Zendo, we adopt some of these practices and various rules and forms and rituals that support our practice, the way we chant and walk and bow. And some of us appreciate these forms and roles and rituals, and some of us find them really challenging. At first encounter, they can seem culturally unfamiliar, arbitrary, irrelevant to the real practice of meditation. But as we practice, ringing the bells, leading the chants, cleaning the altar, managing the zendo, taking people back and forth to Doksan, organizing retreats, more and more we realize that these are not just tasks that are incidental to our Zazen practice. Necessary, maybe not so necessary, chores, but they are not separate from our Zazen practice. They are ways that we practice mindful awareness and ways that we actually actualize the Bodhisattva precepts in our Sangha life. And we discover that these forms have a grace and economy of movement that has been honed over the centuries, which can also be adapted to particular circumstances. Right? Notice we're not sitting facing the wall, as we would be if we were in a monastery, or depends on the configuration of the zendo. We alter that. We tweak things if they're not serving grace and economy of movement. if they're not serving our practice, we tweak them. But none of it is cast in stone. Practicing these Zendo forms and roles can give us a wonderful opportunity to observe our habit patterns as all kinds of anxieties and judgments and resistances arise. You know, how many of you have ever been afraid of making a mistake in the Zendo? You know, oh, did anybody see that? Fear of being judged or criticized, or judgment of others, you know, criticism of others. You may have noticed that as soon as you're keeping an eye on somebody else and noticing what they're doing wrong, you'll misstep yourself. You notice that? You'll blunder yourself. So our Zazen practice gives us a way to stay present with those habit patterns when they arise. To feel the constriction, you know, the tension in our bodies. To moor ourselves in our breath and release. To notice the habitual tapes that run in our minds, and to just take that little gentle way of unhooking ourselves, disidentifying with those habitual tapes. For some of us, it'll come up when we receive instructions or feedback, what feels like criticism. For some of it, we resist giving, you know, some instructions to someone else about how to ring a bell. So over and over again, we come back to the moment, come back to the next breath, to the weight of the bell striker in our hand, the movement of the hand, the sound of the bell. We come back to this person right in front of us who's really nervous about making a bad sound on the bell. And you just show them how to soften the wrist, let the weight of the striker do it. Dogen gives these instructions for living in a medieval Japanese monastery. But it's surprising how much of it's pertinent for our practice even today. The spirit of practice that permeates every part of monastic life, as Dogen describes it, is no different from the spirit of Sangha practice that we can cultivate right here. I'll just give you some examples. There's one whole section in here called the Dharma for Taking Food, which goes into great detail of how to eat in a Zen monastery, right down to do not scratch your head and let dandruff fall into your bowls. So some of the content might seem kind of obsessively finicky. But keep in mind, some of those young monks in those days were probably pretty cured in their manners. And everyone had to live and sit zazen and eat and sleep in pretty confined quarters. So these standards allowed things to proceed smoothly without undue friction, and without having to stop and negotiate everything over and over again every time. Another section is called The Model for Engaging the Way, and that discusses comportment for bathing, brushing the teeth, wearing monk's robes, folding up your bedding, moving around the zendo. Getting off and on your seat. So in a traditional monastery, there would be a platform. So you have to get up on the platform, and your seat would look on the platform, and you would also sleep there. Getting on or off your seat, do not crawl around on the platform. Do not make noise by brushing off your seat. So 600 years later, we're still saying, brush off your seat quietly. Fluff your cushions quietly. And then there's a section that I think is really pertinent for us, called Pure Standards for Temple Administrators. So it addresses the different Sangha leadership positions. and how to practice with them. It's so easy to see these positions as markers of hierarchy and invested with some kind of intrinsic authority, which is actually not the case. That's why it's good for people to rotate, you know, from being Jisha to Ino to Doan and letting go, you know, of that identity. You are not Jisha. You don't even have to watch that Jisha over there because you're not Jisha anymore. Now you're Doan. And you just pay attention to that. And you trust that that person over there is doing that, doing their practice, and that one over there is doing their practice. And that together, we are creating a kind of Buddha body of practice. You trust that the foot over there will do its job and the hand over here will do its job. It's quite marvelous, really. Because what that means is if you wobble a little in your job, you know, what you're doing, is that the whole Buddha body of practice will support you and right you. You catch your balance again. Because we all wobble. You know, we get tired and we wobble and we forget something. Somebody's got your back, right? So it's quite wonderful, really. Dogen stresses over and over that people who have these practice positions should have what is called the mind of the way. In other words, to have, you know, some stability in their practice. And yes, there are positions that are better to give people to who have been practicing for some time, who have some stability in their practice. But I also think that doing these, taking on these practices, these roles, are ways that we awaken the mind of the way. What he calls the mind of the way. Through the doing, through the practice. He describes the mental attitude of these temple administrators, from the abbot to the garden manager, in great detail, and it's kind of fun to read what the garden manager does. It's really, but I can't take the time to give you all that. But he says, in all these positions, benevolence must come first, gentleness must come first. With great compassion and great sympathy to the assembled monks, welcome and serve all from the 10 directions and help the monastery flourish. In the traditional Japanese monastery, there would be 6 major positions: the director, the assistant director, the treasurer. And in a small monastery, those would be combined into one. The Ino, who manages the Zendo. The Tenzo, that's the cook. And the Shisui, who's the work leader, distributes the work to the monks. The job description for the director of a medieval Japanese monastery sounds surprisingly contemporary. The director assigns managers for the various departments of monastic life: the fundraiser, the property manager, the charcoal manager, the miso manager, the gruel manager, the Prajnaparamita Sutra lecturer, the Avatamsaka Sutra lecturer, the bath attendant, the water manager, the garden manager, the mill manager, and the lamp manager. Now, in lay practice communities, we would be more likely to have committees. Maybe not quite as efficient. When Mountain Rain was first forming, we got all excited about organization, and we created all these committees. You know, maybe 2 or 3 people on each committee. And there was the library committee, and there was the, you know, communications committee. And then what happened was they all collapsed because the same people were on all the same committees. And it kind of all collapsed back into one thing, which was the council. There was the practice committee. And then we realized, no, then it's sort of like evolution, you know? Then it started to subdivide again because we realized that the council is what we call is the board, right? And then we realized that there really are distinct functions between the board and the practice committee. So we divided them out again, and that worked much better. And now we're starting up a few more committees again. So it's very... Sangha life has rhythms and fluctuations. And sometimes you just have to recognize that and move with a recognition of change. Dogen says, the director's duty is to accept all the monks and work for the peace of the assembly, but do not take it as important for there to be many monks. Do not take the monks lightly when there are few. How easy it is for us to think that more members is better, you know, or if we had a really big benefactor, then we can have a really nice send-up. Skip a little here. Dogen quotes an even older Chinese text, which says, if the director's capacity for accepting monks is not generous and their heart of affection for monks is not warm, the director cannot protect the assembly. So for all those detailed rules, there's a really warm heart at the center of the community practice. Doesn't mean that there's not a time and place for firmness or discipline, but Dogen says that if the sincerity of a monk's practice is questionable, it may be necessary to admonish them, but listen to what he says, in a discreet place, so that they may renew themselves and abide in Dharma for a long time. In other words, don't shame someone publicly. Don't scold someone and shame someone in front of everyone else. You may just want to check with them and say, yo, what's going on? You seem a little distracted. Then he continues, if there are large mistakes where something has been done intentionally that's harmful in a community, let the abbot know about it in private. Discuss it first. With the leadership, and don't hesitate to do so. He said, for many other affairs that may appear before us, meaning things we think are problematic, you know, in someone. He said, just sit and watch how they succeed. And I think this is great advice for people who are really annoyed by something else they see, you know, that someone else is doing. Because so often you see, slowly, slowly, as people practice, you see a settling. You see a settling into practice. And those things that might have been quirky or annoying, those edges soften. And they soften just by practicing together. This sort of sit and watch, just in quiet observation. And the power of the silent practice together is so strong. And when we do that, sometimes our heart just opens. You know, that person who, you know, we thought was so annoying, and suddenly we just see them as this beautiful, clumsy Buddha, right? Just doing their best, you know? Or spaced out Buddha, right? Just doing their best. Or disorganized Buddha, right? And there's a sweetness in that imperfection. There's something poignant about it, about all of us just bravely coming and trying to do this practice. what impresses me so much about these descriptions in Dogen's manual is that the work is for the community, in communication with community. These people are meeting on a daily basis to kind of check in with each other. And that the positions are not fraught with self-identity. They're not for promotion or praise. They're just to serve the community. The Eno's job is to look after the monks and supervise the monks' hall. The word Eno comes from the Sanskrit karmadana, which means the giver of activity. And in Chinese, the word for Eno is yuezhong, which is the giver of joy, giver of joy. So the Eno is like the nurturer of the monks, the assembly. There's kind of I've called it a mother hen quality, but that's kind of gendered to the Eno. Dogen says the Eno regards with love all those who arrive and compassionately nourishes the monks, so that the assembly's heart becomes the Eno's own heart, and mindfulness of the way becomes the Eno's own mindfulness. When you serve as Eno for a larger chita, you know, week-long sesshin, you know, it's like you have your finger on the pulse of the sangha, and you know who's struggling, you know who has an elderly sick mother at home, you know who's suffering with physical pain or illness, you know, there's a feeling of tending for the sangha that comes. And that can come with any of those roles, you know, even cleaning and sweeping and cleaning the toilet is tending. You know, tending the monastery, tending the sangha. So the more we do these things as practice, the more we come to understand that they're not what they seem initially. We come to see that playing the bells is not performance. That sweeping the zendo is not a chore. That making and serving tea is not servile. That teaching a newcomer how to bow is not being a big shot. That each of these roles is a mindfulness practice in itself and an offering of generosity. And that each person's effort and offering is of great value. And that although a few of those roles do require some specific skills, that those can be learned, and that the monastery is not a meritocracy. And you get rotated out, even if you're good at it. Okay, now I'm going to jump all the way from the 13th century of Dogen to 20th century Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center, who is our Dharma great-great-grandfather. And he taught that the precepts are the foundation of Sangha life. They are the expression of right conduct, right speech, right livelihood, rooted in our Zazen practice, right concentration, right effort, right mindfulness, and held oriented by right view and right intention. So there you have it, the Eightfold Path, the whole package, right? No one element can exist without the others. In balance. I think of the Eightfold Path as a kind of elegant, resilient scaffolding on which we build our practice, that supports our practice. If you've ever been to Japan, you might have seen the traditional way of building scaffolding is out of bamboo poles lashed together. So sometimes in renovating a big old temple, you'll see bamboo scaffolding quite high. Because bamboo is both strong and resilient. And these are big bamboos, big trunks like this, right? Strong and resilient. So we chose bamboo as the kind of logo for our practice period. We've been putting it on the newsletters. The safest place to be in an earthquake is said to be a bamboo grove. Because those roots, have you ever seen, you tried to get bamboo roots out of your garden? They are so gnarly and deep and tough, yeah, that they can hold the earth stable in an earthquake to some extent. So here's what Suzuki Roshi had to say about Sangha life and the precepts. He said, having our own way of life will encourage people to have a more spiritual and more adequate way of life for themselves. We must study our way not only for ourselves but for all people. It is something which we must create or establish starting from our own situation as it is, because our rules are actually for ourselves as human beings. As a Chinese, he refers to, I think it was Baijiang, he's using the Japanese pronunciation, who established the first Chinese Zen monastic standards. And he said, now, as Americans, I feel we must establish an American Shingi, the standards. I'm not saying this jokingly. I'm pretty serious, but I don't want to be too serious. If you become too serious, you will lose your way. On the other hand, if we're playing games with it, we will lose our way. So little by little, with patience and endurance, we must find our way for ourselves. So he's encouraging his Sangha not to just slavishly adhere to a Japanese monastic standard, but to value both continuity and change, adaptation, right? So strength and resilience. He's saying you have to recreate this for yourselves using those deep roots. This book is called Safe Harbor. It's a little manual. It says guidelines, process, and resources for ethics and right conduct in Buddhist communities. And it was put out by the Buddhist Peace Fellowship some years ago. And it's edited by Alan Sanaki, who's a teacher at Berkeley Zen Center and who was president of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship for many years. And in his introduction, he says, our foremost task is to create a safe harbor where each of us can practice freely, seeing ourselves and each other. Practice is never apart from conflict or difficulty, but Shila, precepts, should guide our way and all our relationships. This is what Suzuki Roshi was speaking of, finding our Western path of practice. So this little book is a great resource because it then has three different examples of ethical codes from three different Buddhist centers. It has a couple of essays, one by Jan Chosen Bays, where she talks about missteps on the spiritual path, or I would call them potholes that it's easy to step into. Difficulties arising from misuse of power. Problems arising from idealization and isolation of the teacher. Problems arising from failure to recognize powerful archetypal energies at work. Problems arising from the higher good, which is sort of using certain rationalizations that can obscure something that's harmful. And then abuse of students. And we all know that that's a contemporary problem. So really good resource for nurturing a healthy, resilient sangha. You know, being able to have difficult conversations. And so I just kind of want to make a pitch to wind up my talk about the value, the one thing that I've come to feel is most important besides our deep-rooted practice of zazen and silence is, ironically, speaking. Making speaking a practice and listening a practice. So little in our contemporary lives do we really get a chance to speak from the heart and be heard, be listened to from the heart. You know, if you just go around and listen to contemporary discourse, it's people who are just, you know, maintaining their position, speaking over, interrupting each other. You know, we don't have good ways of public discourse, and more it's reduced to not face-to-face, so there's no facial expression or body language or eye contact. It's screen. You know, so this is really a problem. So many sanghas have adopted the practice of speaking, of talking circles. Comes in part from First Nations practices. And we use it a lot in our sangha, in what we call Dharma seminar formats, where we have a talk and then triads, or sometimes a large circle. And the basic principles are speak and listen from the heart. Speak from your own experience. No need to rehearse ahead of time. No need to compare what you're saying with someone else. Trust that when it comes your turn, you will say what's in your heart to say. It's okay to pass and remain silent. No interrupting, no crosstalk. It's not a discussion. It's a practice of speaking and listening with respect. And this, and one more. Be lean of expression. Isn't that a great phrase? Be lean of expression. And this is a beautiful practice of kind of leveling the field so that people who are completely new feel safe to speak and right alongside somebody who's been around for years. There's because you're speaking from, you know, from your experience. And when we do it in the context of Zendo practice, often there's a focus question or two that people can use, and we ask people not to bring up what someone says in that circle outside with them. So you can trust that somebody's not going to challenge you or probe for more information afterwards. But this is also really good, even just in decision-making and, you know, council or practice committee, so that the quieter people's voices are heard and the more dominant voices are less dominant. So I have really come to feel that this is, you know, making speaking and listening a part of our practice is absolutely essential. In our sangha life. And it's actually sometimes incredibly moving to hear what people offer. So I've been trying to cram a lot in here to this talk, and I guess it's because I have come to value so much lay sangha practice. You know, I just feel it takes so much courage to come and do this practice, you know, without the structure of a monastery, you know, without that container. We create it as best we can each time. And that people come from diverse, you know, backgrounds and come to practice together. And I just find that, I find it so moving every time we do particularly the longer retreats. And I have come to believe that this practice in community is one of the most important things that we can do, and that we contribute. And that to the extent that we can build that strength and resilience in our sanghas, that will flow outward into every other part of community that each of you touches, right? That it contributes to some measure of stability, kindness, sanity in our world. And so the world really needs us to do this. Yeah. So thank you for your patience. Thank you for your listening. And thank you for your courageous practice and coming here this weekend. And you're welcome to us. Yeah. So thanks. Let's chant.
Close with first and third verses.